Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and life coach Wendy Dillard here. It's Friday. It's better than Thursday. It's Friday, December the 1st, 2017. And Wendy, it's been quite a week. We've had our first full week of doing shows. And I don't know about you, but the high hasn't come down very much.
Not for me either. Our inaugural week, I'm not saying that well, inaugural?
Well, it's Friday. We're both having trouble with the words today, but that's okay because it's Friday.
But it's been totally awesome. Totally awesome. I'm so grateful that you and I connected. You found me, but I had been looking for you, and we just didn't know who we were yet. And then once we connected, boom, it's been awesome.
It has been. It's been fantastic, and I can hardly wait for next week, especially since poor Tom. Tom Wells had his debut this morning. And it was a disaster because the technology wasn't working properly. But we've got that part fixed. So hopefully he'll have a good second debut on Monday. But it's been technology fixing day. And fortunately, it looks like it's working now. That's the most important thing. It's all working properly. Well, there's one issue, but we're going to fix that on Monday. So it's working well. Let's just leave it at that. So anyway, well, first of all, I want to reiterate, if there is anybody listening live, right now we don't have perhaps lots of live listeners. We got tons of people listening to the podcast after the fact, the recorded stuff. But if you are listening live, feel free to call in and talk with us. We'd love to talk with you. Phone number here, 860-264-5432. And the topic I came up with for today, Wendy, was based on an article that I found at the website of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. They have their own ABC. And ABC in Australia, ABC in Australia, they have a medical reporter named Sophie Scott, and she wrote an article that had a rather curious headline. And when I saw the headline, I said, that might be a good topic. The headline was, Why a Meaningful Life Might Matter More Than Happiness. Now, I don't know about you, but the first time I saw that, I said to myself, why do we have to pick? Why do I have to pick a meaningful life or happiness as great? Why does one have to be better than the other? And I think that's why I thought this would make a good topic. If it also gives us an opportunity.
How for you, it caused you to ask a question like, well, why do you have to choose? And for me, I'm still scratching my head going, what do I do with that? So I'm really interested in unraveling this as we open up the topic.
Okay. Well, what the author did was she drew heavily on the work of an American who is an instructor in the field of positive psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, which is a kind of a hotbed of positive psychology. Her name is Emily Smith. I won't try to pronounce her middle name. Emily, if you hear this, please forgive me, but I don't do well with names that I've never seen before. And especially ones where the consonants don't go together in a way I'm used to. But Emily Smith has done extensive work, apparently, investigating what is a meaningful life and what's involved and what kind of role and impact it has on our lives and our communities. And when this particular author, Sophie Scott, did research regarding what Ms. Smith had written, she found that Smith had come up with four key elements of what she considers it to be necessary to live a life of meaning. The first is belonging. She says finding your tribe or developing relationships where you feel understood, recognized, and valued. That's belonging. The second one is purpose. Purpose is the feeling like you are doing something worthwhile, that you are using your strengths. And she points to a scientific survey that can help you identify your particular strengths. I'm not sure that you need a survey that's scientific, but okay. You know, I guess it's better than unscientific. Sure, why not? The third point is storytelling. That's what I really like. Storytelling. We all tell stories about ourselves and create a narrative about our past, which helps us make sense of who we are today. Boy, we could probably do a whole show on that one. And then
kind of interesting that she put that in there as one of the four things.
I think
that's cool.
It is. It's fascinating, and I think it's spot on, actually. And then the fourth one is transcendence. This means finding those awe-inspiring moments, whether it's being in nature or feeling you are part of something larger than yourself. You might feel this through meditation or yoga or something creative, such as music or whatever. So those are the four cornerstones, so to speak: belonging, purpose, storytelling, and transcendence. And those four pieces make up a meaningful life, according to Dr. Smith, I presume she's a doctor. What do you think?
I'm sorry, did you ask a question?
I said, what do you think?
Well, I like all those pieces. The storytelling one, that's the one I thought was pretty unusual, but as I'm thinking on it, I think what she's saying is, I mean, in terms of what creates a meaningful life, do we think that the stories that we've been telling or the narrations that we've been focused on about our past are things that we're liking or enjoying?
That's where I think you could have a really long conversation devoting an entire show to just that one leg of the four legs, because I agree with
you.
I mean, I think most people have a lot of negative stories from their past, and we do have a tendency to keep repeating them to ourselves under various circumstances. And that actually doesn't serve us very well. So storytelling, it's like you say, it's an interesting thing to include, because storytelling is also about making up your own story, changing the story to what you want to be so you can change your mindset about it. So you can actually look at it either way.
Well, so in other words, what you just said is, if the story that you're telling doesn't feel good to you, and you begin to shift it into a story that sounds better and makes you feel better, you can take a life that maybe before didn't feel like it had much meaning and actually convert it into a life where you do feel like you have meaning.
Right. Yes, exactly. And it's an art. I don't know about you. Have you tried that much? I've tried it some. And it's awful hard sometimes to get off of, well, that's not what actually happened. And changing in my mind, no, I'm not trying to, you know, pretend that the old history isn't there. I'm just trying to change my way of thinking about it. It's resistant,
yeah,
you know?
When I started knowing Abraham, I listened to how they would reframe a story with mm-hmm. such beauty and with such eloquence. And I thought, I want to do that. So I would try to do that. And, oh, my goodness, I felt like I failed every time. I'm like, this is hard. Because I didn't realize how invested I was in holding on to what I thought was the truth, the factual, rigid, this is what really happened. And because I held so tight to what I perceived really happened, I had a hard time shifting it. Then I came to recognize how I was holding so tightly to what I thought was. And I started to kind of uncover how much of a premium I put on what my version of the truth was. And so I just kind of started asking questions of my inner being, of spirit, of the universe. How do I shift this? Because I know it's not serving me to hold on to this perception.
Right.
And honestly, Walt, I'm not exactly sure what I did or how I did it. But I know it was about 3 years later, after I had been listening to Abraham, you know, constantly revamping stories. And I do remember 3 years before, I set the intention. I said, I am going to master artful storytelling.
Mm.
And like I said, I didn't know how that was going to happen. But 3 years later, I was listening to, like, the same CD when I remembered, oh, that was the intention I set. And I went, oh, I have become an artful storyteller.
Uh-huh.
And I can pretty much turn any story around. Now, I can do it for anybody else, like almost on a dime. Doing it for myself is coming easier, but from time to time I have a story that I feel like I'm really invested still in where I am, and it's not working for me. So then I have to poke around and ask more questions. And once I get the recognition, I just got to ask some good questions, then new information starts to flow. But, you know, it's not an art form that I was ever trained in growing up. You know, I was kind of trained in, I had parents, especially my mother, who was all about the facts are what the facts are, and that's the truth you have to report, and that's what you have to say over and over, because that's the truth. And so that's how I grew up, and
yeah.
So that's why I think turning things around didn't come so naturally, but I think they do now. Because
oh, yeah.
I've been really putting a lot of effort on it.
Oh, I agree. I mean, it was hard for me, too, for very much the same reason, because of the way we're trained when we're growing up and when we're brought up. And to learn and even test and try the idea that I can change the story, really? That's a lot. That's a lot to overcome at first. Eventually, it's not so difficult. But early on, it's like, wow, are you really allowed to do that?
You know, I was listening to an Abraham CD a while back, and the guy who was in, you know, they call it the hot seat, whoever
yeah.
the participant is that's asking Abraham questions.
Right.
He was doing such an incredible job of storytelling that I was sitting there as I'm listening going, is he talking about the future or is he talking about the present? And the more details he added, the more I couldn't tell, because I thought when he started his conversation, he was asking a question about the future. But then as he talked more about it, he was using all these present tense verbs. And then it was really funny because Abraham said to, like, okay, everybody who's listening, you probably have no idea if he's talking about the present or the future. And everyone is like, yeah, we don't know. Well, it turned out he was talking about the future, but he was so artful at talking about it with present tense. You know, Abraham said, there's no doubt that this is going to be three-dimensional manifestation almost immediately. And I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
I want to be able to do that. So that was like my next level. And, I mean, I've had to overcome some challenges in how I could talk about the present, or I should say, how I could talk about future manifestation in present tense without feeling to myself like I was lying or deceiving myself. And well, so do you want to know how I was able to make that
shift? I'm just sitting here on pins and needles. Tell me.
Well, I thought, you know, I've heard Abraham say this many times, that when you have had a contrasting negative experience, in the moment that happens, at the same time, the solution is born. Well, the solution at this point in time is existing in vibrational reality, even if it's not in our earthly three-dimensional reality.
The first thought going to my mind is, okay, well, it doesn't do me any good over there.
So this is what I did. I went, well, I do believe in what Abraham says. I do believe that my source being is holding on to many things that I have been desiring.
Okay.
I do believe that very strongly, and there's nothing in me that sways or doubts on that point or perspective. So I thought, okay, if the solution is born in the moment the problem occurred, then my truth, and this is what I said to me, my truth is that in vibrational reality, this thing that I want is already done. And so if I speak in present tense, saying this thing is already done, like let's say I need or want a new car, and I say, my new car is already parked in my driveway, I can say that in present tense because as I'm focused on what my vibrational reality is and what my inner source being knows, I know that to be true. And so, in my mind's eye, I shifted my present tense truth to what is happening on a spiritual plane. And I believe that is true as to what's happening on a spiritual plane. And so, that kind of dissipated me focusing on the what is in this three-dimensional physical reality. I'm like, I'm not going to talk about my three-dimensional reality anymore. I'm going to talk about what's in my vibrational reality. Because that is present tense.
That's cool that you were able to make that shift like that, because that's not necessarily an easy shift to make, but you did it. And the way you did it was, again, very cool. I think one thought that comes to my mind is I went through very much a similar kind of transition, although my transition, you know, obviously I have different experiences, so my transition was a bit different too. Mine happened because when was it? It was almost 10 years ago. About 9 years ago, I decided for the first time in my life to write a novel. And I won't even go into why I decided to do it. It was politically based, and I've been since then trying to move away from politically oriented anything. But that was what my motivation was at the time. And it was actually a really good exercise because I didn't want to write it as a nonfiction book. I mean, I figure there's plenty of self-help type and, advice books and all that out there. I wanted to write it as something that would be entertaining fiction. So I sat down to write, and I realized I didn't know how to tell a story. How do you do it? I had no idea. I mean, I had some small idea, but, certainly not enough to grasp the bull by the horns and start writing it. I tried writing a couple paragraphs, and I looked at it, and I said, well, that's just crap. Just not very good at all. Fortunately, I had an ace in the hole. My ace in the hole is my sister, who was a theater major when she was in school and has always been a major student of drama and literature and the arts in general. And so I said, well, PJ should be able to teach me how to write a story, how to write fiction. So I called her up, and she said, sure. And we had a long conversation, and she explained to me how you put together the storyline and how you outline stuff, and you're building your characters and how you build your conflict and your resolution, and how important it is to do actions instead of everything is about this is, because that's boring, and a whole bunch of stuff like that. And after we'd had actually a few conversations, but it was one really main one that was the biggest difference, I sat down and started to try it again. And the second time that I tried to write the stuff, it was better. It still wasn't fit for human consumption, but it was a lot better. And I just kept trying to rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it. And then I would share stuff with her, and she'd say, well, okay, this is where it's not working, and here's why it's not working. And we just kept working through it over and over again. Finally, one day, I was about maybe a quarter to a third of the way through the story. And I don't know exactly why, but somehow what she'd been teaching me clicked in a way that it hadn't clicked before. And all of a sudden, I started writing this action tale that was actually pretty good by the time I was done with it. I mean, even at this early stage, it wasn't all that great, but it was at least an action tale, and there was stuff going on, and, there was actually a car chase even in it.
Wow.
Yeah. Not bad for somebody who didn't know how to tell a story. So,
right.
So I'm learning how to weave this stuff together and running it past her, and she's saying, okay, do this, do that, skip that, move that, all that kind of thing. And you do that often enough and long enough, you actually start to learn how to tell a story. So that by the time I was done, I actually had a pretty good novel by the time I was done. Now, it didn't sell many copies because I don't have any kind of an agent, and I didn't have any mass market to sell it to. So I probably sold 20 copies of it. But the good news is that the people who read it liked it. They enjoyed it. They thought it was a good read. And especially considering that the subject matter had such a political / economic slant to it, shall we say, which makes it really tough to read a novel, let me tell you. Despite the fact that I had that, they still liked it. I said, okay, well, then I guess I did pretty good on it. That was a great experience.
Hey, Walt, I just want to stop and acknowledge, you took the time and had the perseverance to not only learn storytelling, but then to use that in writing a book.
Yes.
That in itself, how many people have we heard, one day I'm going to write the great American novel, and they never do it? You did it.
I did it. Yeah, that's true. And,
yeah,
and it was a good experience.
That's a big deal.
I mean, it took a year out of my life, but it was well worth it. I learned a lot about myself doing it. I learned that there are holes that existed in my self-perception, my sense of self that I didn't know were there, and I've been working on those since then. I mean, I learned a lot about how other people think, because when you write a story, you need to write it so that it will appeal to them from their sensibilities. So, I mean, I learned a lot about myself and how I relate to the rest of the world just by doing that exercise. Plus, I learned how to write a story.
Now, that to me is a very valuable year.
Oh, yeah.
And so my question is, what is the meaning that you choose to put on that year of your life?
That was the year I learned how to tell a story. And that's a very short sentence, but it encapsulated in that sentence is a whole lot of feeling of accomplishment.
Hmm. Well, since we're talking about having a meaningful life in this part of the conversation, I wanted to tie it back to meaning, because I was hearing from you that there was a lot of meaning in there that maybe you hadn't really stopped to just unpack and acknowledge.
Yeah, it takes a while. You can't actually unpack it all at once. It happens over time. But yeah, there was a ton of stuff. I'm sitting here saying, how do I chronicle all of it? And I can't. There's not enough time in the show. But yeah, it almost sounds trite to say it, but I just learned so much out of that experience.
Well, what matters is, did you have fun doing it?
I did, actually. There were times when it was not fun. There are times when writing is a drag. There were other times, and they coincided with when the story was getting really good, that the writing was fun. When the story isn't moving along as fast, it can be really tedious. When the story's moving along, man, you can hardly get the words down fast enough. It's true. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's almost like you're living your own movie.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, which was more important, the happiness or the meaning? I don't want to try to separate one from the other. They were both there in large quantities. For me, it's all one package.
Now, I don't think you finished the article because we jumped off and started talking about the meaning part because that was interesting to me. But wasn't there a contrast that had to do with happiness?
Yes, yeah, she was contrasting it with an earlier article that she had written called Road Testing Happiness. And she actually didn't spend a lot of time building that part out. It's only like, I don't know, 7 or 8 paragraphs or something like that. But what she concluded was pretty much what we concluded. I mean, she says, but maybe focusing on these 4 pillars of meaning is just as important as the previous paragraph, which says, as the scientific studies show, being happier can help you live longer and healthier. So she's saying they're both important. And I agree. I think they are both important. I think they actually are almost inseparable.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking they're very much the same. And you could maybe even say, you know, a happy life, you know, includes these 4 things.
Yeah.
And kind of all comes together. But, you know, happiness to me is creating meaning in your life. You know, the I think point 2 had to do with purpose. What do you find in your life that is worthwhile?
Mm-hmm.
Are you doing the thing that, you know, I liked how the author put it. It had to do with, like, are you using your strengths?
Right. Yes.
Which I'll jump off and say something I learned about strengths, which I found was really fascinating.
Okay.
I was reading a book by the guys that do the Gallup poll.
Yeah.
It's called Strength Finders, I believe is the book title.
Okay.
And in the book, there's a quiz. And online, you do the quiz, and then you get your response. And it's like it names out of, I don't even know, 40, 50 different categories what your top 5 strengths are. But what the most fascinating part was, as I was reading the details of, you know, what composes your strengths, I realized that I had always thought your strengths were the things that you were good at.
Ah.
I mean, don't you think that's what most people, I mean, do you think your strength is what you're good at?
I think on one level that's true. I think on another level we often don't even realize what our strengths are, and so we don't always think of them as things that we're good at. I think there's certainly a lot of parallel between them, but I don't think they're necessarily the same.
Well, so I had just always thought a strength, you know, when you think of strengths or weaknesses, it's like what are you good at versus what do you need to improve upon? Well, the authors in this book considered your strengths was something that when you did it, you felt energized.
Yeah, I like that.
And your, quote, weaknesses are the things that drained your energy.
Yes.
So that concept in itself really got my eyeballs to go, whoa! So then it suggested a little test, which I decided to do because this really had my attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a week, every time during the course of my week, I did something that I could tell really energized me, I would make note of it. And likewise, every time I did something that really drained me, I made note of it. And then the idea is, after a 5 or 7 day week, you know, analyze the data and see what you have.
Okay. What'd you find?
I was shocked at my results.
Okay.
Because at the time I was working a day job, and so that's where I was writing stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
I had one experience that energized me.
Really?
And I had one, yes, and I had one experience that drained me. So I think the natural question is, what about the rest of the time?
I was just wondering, what happened the rest of the time?
Well, what I assessed for myself was I was doing stuff I was really good at, but it neither energized me nor drained me. I felt like I was an automaton. I was just a robot doing a job.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I can identify with that. Yeah.
And I mean, that was really kind of my first clue. Like, maybe this is not the place for me to stay.
Right.
Because, you know, based on what we're talking about, like these four cornerstones, I wasn't really feeling like I was really being contributing anything that was worthwhile, or maybe I was to my company, but certainly not to me.
Right. Which is actually more important in some ways.
Go ahead.
It's actually more important in some ways because, yeah, the company perhaps gets some value out of it, but if you're not getting value out of it, it's really not a good trade. I mean, even if they're paying you for it, if you're not getting what you need out of it, money only goes so far, you know? I know it's a strange thing to say.
That was kind of what I concluded. I went, I don't know that this job is really giving me enough for me to continue to stay here.
Yeah.
And then I did look at the one thing that drained me, and then I looked at the one thing that energized me.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly, right now, I can't think of the thing that drained me, but the thing that energized me is I had had a 45-minute call that week with my HR department.
Uh-huh.
And the purpose of the call was to just consider, are there any other positions at this company that I could possibly move into? And I was very aware that how the whole conversation went, we were talking about my strengths. We were talking about what makes me light up. I was saying, oh, and I love to do this. I love to train. Any opportunity I have to teach, I'm all over it. I'm good at spreadsheets. I love numbers. I love to analyze data. And I just was talking about the things that I really, really enjoyed. And I also recognize I love to talk about possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Because HR would feed back to me, well, there is this job opening for blah, 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 blah. And I was like, ooh, maybe I could fit into that. And I just love to think about what's possible. And, oh, my goodness, I remember when I got off that phone call, I was disappointed it was only 45 minutes. I was on a high for like 2 hours.
Wow, yeah.
And I'm like, I mean, talk about being energized. This was excitement to me. And I went, wow, I need to, and I recognized I need to be in some kind of environment or in some kind of job where I get to talk about the possibilities of the future, where I get to spin some tale about what could be.
Right.
In that environment, I shine, I light up, I'm excited, I'm happy, I'm passionate, I feel like I'm on fire in a good way.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was just really fascinating to me, and I have not forgotten it at all. That was probably, I don't know, 8 years ago that I read that book and I learned this. And I've now coined my own phrase, what comes natural to you is breathing. And when I'm teaching or training, it comes as natural to me as breathing.
Okay.
I don't require forethought. I don't require preparation. I just open my mouth and I go.
It makes sense.
And not only is it easy, which that kind of puts it in the strength category, but it energizes me and just, it fulfills me on so many levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that to me is how I know I'm doing my purpose.
This is really touching on something that is highly motivating and highly meaningful to me, because actually for most of my working life, I ended up doing jobs not because I loved them, but because I was good at them. And it may sound strange to some people, but just because you're good at something doesn't mean you love it. There are a lot of things I'm good at that I don't love.
Yeah, that's what I found through this book.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's one of the big motivators for me with this podcast, because for the first time, really in my life, I found something to do that I absolutely love. I can hardly wait for our next podcast every day, Wendy. I mean, it's just, we got a weekend coming up. Oh, no. I have to wait 2 whole days. Oh, no. Good. I get to do one day with David on Sunday. It's almost like an addict, you know? But it's such a new experience for me because for so long I was in the other role. And what makes it even worse in the other role, the one where you're just doing the job because you're good at it, is it wears you down in ways that you don't even necessarily notice. I would say in the last 2 to 3 years in particular, for many years I was doing website development and online marketing and stuff like that. And within the last couple of years, without my even being aware of it, I came to realize that it was almost like going to the dentist. It was that unpleasant to me. I was doing it. I had to do it, but it just wasn't fun anymore. And when it came very, very recently, when it came down to sitting down and writing some code or something, I wanted to be anywhere but sitting at the computer doing that. Anything else, please, anything. So,
well, and it's very possible to be doing something and love it for a while or for a long time, and then after time, it loses its fizzle.
I'll take your word for it. I don't usually get that opportunity based on my life in the past. I'm hoping that I get that opportunity in the future and present, but that's not been my past experience. My past experience has been about doing stuff I didn't love at all.
I was going to say, I don't know if I shared this with you, but I was a costume designer for 15 years.
Yes, yes.
And when I first was doing it, I mean, oh my God, it was so exciting to me. I was freelancing. Everything was new. Everything was exciting. I was meeting new people. I was doing new designs. I got to be out shopping all the time. I was in my car. I was listening to fabulous personal development stuff while I was driving. I got to incorporate visiting friends in between my days. Once we were doing live shows, it was fun to hear the audience applause, and I was involved in fast changes, so there was a lot of fast pace going on. And, I mean, every aspect about it that I could think of was truly dynamic and so met my need for fulfillment like you would not believe.
Wow. That's pretty good stuff
right
there.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I was a freelance designer for 10 years. And then it was starting to get a little rote. It was starting to feel like there wasn't as much variety because I'd done all this stuff already.
Mm-hmm.
And we were reusing the costumes I'd already created.
Oh, yeah.
And I was working with the same cast of characters, so it wasn't like I was meeting new people.
Right.
And so even making time to go to lunch with them, you know, before a dress rehearsal was like, you know, I've got other things to do. I'll show up later. And so I needed to re-energize myself because it was not fun anymore. So somebody I had known when I was working at a costume shop, he and I became partners, and we started a costume manufacturing company.
Hmm.
So now it was something new. It was something, you know, I love to talk about what's possible for the future, and we were re-envisioning what could happen, and we started doing that. And now that was exciting again, and mm-hmm. it was a whole different ball game.
Okay.
And then, you know, probably around year 3.5, 4, I'm like, well, it reinvigorated me for a short time, but it's just not doing it for me anymore. And by the end of 5 years, I just had a sense of I'm done. I absolutely could care less about anything that has to do with theater, costumes, or any of it. I'm just so over it. And I remember thinking, can I retire? I think I'm too young to retire. Is it okay to retire? And if I do retire, what do I do next?
Right.
So, you know, long story short, I did retire from that. I put away all things costuming, and I moved on. But I realized this was something that just so enthralled me. And I remember in my first couple years, my best friend said to me, oh, my God, Wendy, how can you work so much? You work day and night. And my response was, I don't work at all.
Yes.
It's all play. I mean, I'm playing all the time, and yes, it's fun. I get paid for it. But when it stopped being play and it started feeling like work, that's how I knew something big had shifted. And so I have had that experience of doing a thing I was good at and loving it and having it be so fun I would do it even if I didn't get paid,
mm.
to to the point that I was still getting paid, and there was no amount of money that was worth it anymore.
That actually makes a lot of sense. It brings to mind an old cliche, variety is the spice of life. And I would say we just need to modify that a little bit and say variety is the spice of play. You see what I mean? Because when we play, especially if it's freeform play, the moment that what we're playing isn't interesting, we just start playing something else. We don't mess around, right? It's not like, oh, I have to keep playing with these wooden soldiers, so I'm going to keep doing that. No, that's not the way play works when you're a kid, certainly. And even when you're playing with something as an adult. If you're not into it, you just change what you're playing to something else. You play with whatever the next interesting thing is. That's the nature of play. So play depends upon the spice, upon the thing that makes it interesting. And once the spice is gone, then you find some new spice with some new play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what you've been doing, and which is fantastic, by the way. I mean, to be
so,
able...
Yeah, and I'm in another transition in my life, looking for the thing that will give me that same level of satisfaction or greater than when I was in my early costuming days. Because my heart was singing all the time. I could wait to wake up and start the day again. And I stayed up as long as I could until literally my eyeballs could not stay awake anymore. Now, granted, I was also in my much earlier years in my life, and I don't believe in age, but I was at a different point where what I recognize now is I've lived so much more of life that my filters for selection have shifted.
Right.
You know, I did a lot of things to experiment with, well, would I like this? Would I like that? Well, I don't experiment quite as often because things that come into my world, now I can decide I don't want to experiment or go down that road. I've already done it, and yes, I like it, or no, I don't.
What we're actually talking about here is being a play expert. I started to say that you were a playaholic, and I said, no, that's got too much of a negative connotation to it. But
I'm a masterful playster? I don't know.
A playster, yeah. I like that. A playster, that's good.
Yeah, let's make up some words today.
Sure, we'll make little name badges. Playster, you know?
Well, you know, happy had been my word for a good while, and it still is. But, you know, I like the idea of incorporating the word play and having that be something I focus on, because I know whatever I focus on, I attract more of it into my life.
Right, yeah.
And when I started hanging things all around my house that had the word happy or happiness, my happiness quotient increased. And I'll tell you, I could do with some more play. I really could. So I think I'm going to take that and I'm going to start focusing on the word play and see what shows up.
Okay. You know, as you said that.
I'll be playful.
I'm sure, yes. And as you said that about how you put, you know, the words around the house and so forth, it made me think of something that I keep thinking of to do and I haven't done it yet. By golly, I got to really do it. I wanted to get a bunch of photos, you know, find a bunch of photos online of young faces, smiling, happy faces, and even not quite so young, but smiling and happy, because it's really the smiling and happy part that I'm looking for. And then have those all printed up and put those all over the walls of my office so that every day when I come in, I see all these happy, smiling faces smiling at me, because I have a feeling it's going to have the same kind of effect as your words do.
Yeah.
Now, why haven't I done that? I don't know why.
I'm thinking that's even more effective than having the word smile or the word happy.
Kind of, yeah. Because it's visual.
I mean, when I see someone smile, I can't help but smile back.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a normal human reaction, really. In fact, I found
that out. I'm smiling right now. I can't help it. It's like almost every day when we're doing this show, it's like my smile muscles actually hurt. Because I've been smiling the whole time we're talking.
Yeah. Well, that's how you know that you're in a good zone, because your smile muscles hurt, so the vortex is really high.
The vortex is smiling back at me.
Well, I was telling you the other day how I was taking a walk, and I was listening to the tunes, and I was feeling really, really good, and I was looking at other people, and they were giving me these big grins back, so I knew I must have a smile on my face. I wasn't aware of it at the time. But it goes to show you have an effect on other people, and all of a sudden, oh my goodness, everybody's smiling at me.
Have you ever walked around a mall and purposely attempted to influence other people to smile?
I have not, but then again, I haven't been in a mall in about 5 years. So
okay, so forget the mall. Go to the grocery store. Go to Best Buy. Wherever you're out and about, I have had so much fun. There are some days I just get in a mood. I get out of the car and I go, I'm going to get five people to smile at me.
Mm.
And the ones that are the most difficult, I just set this. It's like I can tell they are just in a grumpy, grouchy, they don't want to put a smile on their face mood. And if I can't get it, that's okay, and I move on to the next person. But I just have such a desire to put a smile on their face, not because I want it for me, but I know that when they smile, they get to feel good.
That's
and
true.
I'd like to be able to influence that if at all possible.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It's worthwhile for you or anybody who's listening to just take the smile challenge and see if you can put the smile on five people's faces today.
We have the smile. The gauntlet has been tossed down. See if you
only
can smile.
Only if it feels good to you. Don't do it if you think it's a should, because I don't like the should.
No, of course not. I'm being silly about the gauntlet. But I can't honestly say that I've ever tried to do it as a challenge and followed through on it. I remember once or twice saying I was going to do it as a challenge to myself, and it didn't really work. But what I do is there are many days where I'm in the store and I see, you know, the usual moderately unhappy faces, we'll call it that, and I just feel motivated to greet some people. You know, so smile, hi, how you doing? Smile, hi, how you doing? And just, you know, do that as I'm going through the store. Not as a challenge, just because I want to, you know, bring a little happiness to them. And you're right, that does produce some interesting results. Sometimes they just don't pay any attention. Sometimes you get what I call the eye flick. You know what I mean? That's the person who is so absorbed in being miserable, but they did notice you, so they give you a little flick of the eyes and then they look away.
Yes. Well, have you ever noticed how many people cannot look at you when
yeah.
you walk by?
Yeah, they turn the eyes down, yeah.
And yeah, or they just want to pretend that you do not exist.
The one thing that makes it easier for me is my height. I don't know if I've told you. I'm 6'8" tall, so I'm pretty darn tall.
Oh, my gosh. No, yeah. You didn't tell me.
Yeah, I'm pretty tall. And so I tend to get attention anyway just because of my height. So I can be walking through the store. Most often it's going to be a kid, and the kid's going to say, "Wow, Mommy, he's tall." And the mom's like, "Shh, don't."
Really? Look at that giant.
So I don't have a whole lot of trouble getting people to pay attention to me in the store just because all I have to do is walk by and they say, "Oh, wow." You know? But so when they're walking by and then I give them a smile, it's almost like I let them off the hook or something because they knew that they were looking at me. And now they feel better about it. So it's not so hard for me to do it.
So this idea that I have about smiling at others, to me, is such a win-win, because when I set the intention, whether I call it a challenge or it's just something fun to do, when I set the intention that I want to smile at people, first of all, I'm getting to feel good, because you can't not feel good when you're smiling.
True.
And the second thing is, if you can put a smile on someone else's face because you just happened to walk by or because you smiled at them or for whatever reason, it's a win for them because now they have a moment to feel good.
That's right. Yep.
And sometimes I like to make up stories, you know, like somebody who's having a hard time, you know, smiling and they don't want to look at me. I'll just make up a scenario in my head about how they've been having just a really rough day. And what they didn't yet know is they really just needed to have somebody arbitrarily, out of the blue, smile at them so it can kind of distract them from feeling so unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be the person. Hey, I can influence, can't I?
Sure, why not? Every reason why you should do it.
Yeah.
Because it's good for you and it's good for them. It's good for everybody who's involved, really, when you think about it.
Good for everybody. So I like your idea of finding a bunch of smiling faces and just, you know, plastering them all around your office environment, because I think that would absolutely put a smile on your face every day.
I'm hoping that just because I said that, I'm going to say, okay, now I'm going to do it. Now I'm just going to get it done. Because I've been saying this to myself for like the last year and a half. I figure it's about time I got the thing done, you know? But what you're talking about, what you're talking about with people in the store and making them smile, my wife is really, really good at that, particularly with crying children. She has a knack. And we could be, like, you know, you mentioned the grocery store. We could be at the grocery store in the checkout line, and in front of us there's a frazzled mom and their kid's in the cart and a little seat in the cart there and crying and, you know, nothing that the mom can do settles them down and so forth. And Louise will just look at him. And as soon as he sees that she's looking at him, he stops and just look on his face. And she keeps looking and she's smiling at him, and he just looks some more. And within seconds, he starts to smile, and the mom is saying, "Oh, thank God!" Louise is so good at that. It's just—I mean—and she can do it with a kid who, not just the kid who's like right next to us. She can do it with a kid who's like three aisles over, and she'll just look at the kid, and all of a sudden, the kid will just snap the head right at her. It's amazing. I've never seen anything like that.
Well, you know, when I think about, because I mean, every time you go to the grocery store or at a restaurant, it's so common, or in the airport or on an airplane, you know, there's somebody crying because, you know, hey, that's part of being a kid, right?
Sure.
Because they're asking for what they need. And the parent is going, "I'm not quite sure what it is I can give you. You know, I don't know what you need. You need to use words, and you don't have words yet."
That's right.
But what I think is fascinating is that people around a crying child have such a powerful impact on whether that child continues to cry or whether they stop.
Mm-hmm.
And you just brought up the situation where it sounds like your wife's intention is to just connect with that child in a way that the child will just be able to, like, come into their own sense of well-being.
Yeah, literally, the way she explains it to me is she's trying to say with the look on her face, "I see you.
Yeah.
I see you. I am aware of your existence. I recognize you. I see you."
Which is such a beautiful acknowledgement of another human being.
Mm.
And oftentimes, you know, no disrespect at all to parents, but oftentimes a parent is just so overwhelmed by all the things that are going on in their life, and the last thing they need to do is have their kid cry because they're like, "Oh my God, what else do you want now?" Not to mention, you can't always figure out what it is that the child needs or wants when they're crying.
And plus, there's also a frustration when it happens in public too, because when it's in public, now it's embarrassing on top of everything else.
Exactly. But what I was going to add is, on the flip side to what your wife is doing, is if people around this crying child are really frustrated or angry or don't like what the parent's doing or not doing or whatever, they don't, oftentimes people don't realize they're adding their resistance.
Yes.
And that child oftentimes is feeling that too. And it actually exacerbates the crying.
It does.
And so, yeah, and so what I know my intention when I'm around a crying child, I just ask, is there something I can do to contribute to this child right now?
Mm-hmm.
And some days I get a yes, and I'll know what to do, whether it's smile or just sit quietly. And other times it's like, no, just let the child be. And that's kind of like one of the points we talked about yesterday on one of the universal laws about I am who I am and allow others to be who they are. And when I feel like there's nothing specific that's being required of me or asked of me to intervene on this child's behalf, kind of like what your wife was doing, I just, in my own mind, I acknowledge that this child is asking for something, and this child deserves to be answered. And the answer is there, because in the moment they ask for something, the solution is always given.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, and so I just sit in the quietness of everything's okay. Nothing's broken. You know, no need goes unmet unless they choose to close themselves off to receiving it. But, you know, all is well in the world. And so I like to be a part of being an influence for good,
mm-hmm,
in any given situation. But that's kind of something I do when there's a crying child, because I do know I have influence power.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, and Abraham says that one person being aligned to source energy in their state of well-being is more powerful than 1 million that is not aligned to source energy.
Yeah, I think that's true. And by the way, I've also tried my wife's technique. Once she explained to me what she was doing, I've tried it a few times. And I found it's about 90% successful for me. For my wife, it's 100% successful. I've never seen her fail at it. For me, it's 90% successful. And really, all I ever do is I just do what she told me to do. See the child. And so I'll be looking at the child. I'll put a smile on my face, open my eyes wide, and just wait for the child to see me. And when the child sees me, 90% of the time, he or she just stops. It's like they forgot what they were doing. They forgot they were crying. What were they crying about? They can't remember. It's amazing.
But, you know, that concept is so rich. I think there's not one human on the planet that doesn't desire to be seen and acknowledged.
I think that's true, and I think it's also true that when we try to apply the same technique to non-children, to adults, the result may not be as positive because adults have learned so many ways to shut down from their own happiness. But even then, the breakthroughs still happen at a pretty good clip. It's pretty remarkable.
I hear those prescription things that you get on the commercials that says, and your results may vary.
Your results may vary, right. But unlike what the commercial says, do try this at home.
Right. It's like, if you have been trained as a child to shut down when other people look at you, this technique may not work. However, if you are highly susceptible to, like, outbursts of happiness, this may work exactly right for you, and you don't even need to ask your doctor about it.
Meanwhile, there are patent attorneys who are just scratching their heads saying, I don't know what to do with this.
Oh, my goodness. I don't even know where we are anymore in reference to our topic. I just know we've been having a good time talking.
Well, actually, we've been pretty much on spot on with the topic, because the topic was a meaningful life and happiness and what's the relationship between the two of them. That's pretty much what we've been talking about here. So we haven't deviated all that far. We just haven't actually mentioned the topic lately, but other than that, we're right there.
Well, I know we've talked a lot about points number 2 and 3. Remind me what point 1 and 4 were.
1 was belonging and 4 was transcendence.
Ooh, so, transcendence. That's a very cool word.
It is, yes. So transcendence, this means finding those awe-inspiring moments, whether it's being in nature or feeling you are part of something larger than yourself. You might feel this through meditation, yoga, or something creative such as music.
You know, I feel like I have many transcendent moments because I have lots of ahas. I have lots of awe-inspiring, oh my gosh, this is so incredible. But I haven't had one of those transcendent moments where you stare into a sunset and just feel that rush of excitement. I haven't had one of those in a while. Maybe because I haven't stepped outside and stared at a sunset in a while.
You're actually describing one of my favorite activities. Not so much sunsets, but beautiful outside weather. I guess that's where the weather is, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I've never mastered bringing the outside in.
It's probably not a good idea.
Stay outside.
Well, I mean, when the fog gets all over the furniture, forget it. I mean, you never get it out. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, speaking of outdoors, so my nieces were here over the weekend, and one of them is a brilliant photographer, and she was going to take some new headshot pictures for me, and her specialty is doing things outdoors, and she's so fabulous with, like, knowing the lighting and whatever, and she said, we don't need to go until 4:30, and I'm like, well, won't we lose the light? She goes, that's the exact light that I want to capture. I'm like, okay, so I took her lead. And what was so funny is we could not control the breeze.
Oh.
And my hair is so fine anyway that my hair was going every which way. And fortunately, she's like, I'm just going to keep snapping the camera. If you need to move your hair out of your face, it's totally okay. But we laughed most of the day because we were just sort of fighting against the wind. And after a while, it's like, let's just go with the breeze. And some of my favorite pictures were ones where you could tell that there was a breeze blowing, and I went, you know, even though it's a still photo, there's a feeling of motion in it.
Yes.
Because hair only looks that way because wind has blown it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody like prints their hair and goes, make it look like this. And I went, oh, that's really cool. So that to me is like, I couldn't bring the outside in, because normally I prefer, like, in order to get my hair coiffed exactly the way I want it, you have to do it inside.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it totally worked. I worked outside, and we just had so much fun being outside in a beautiful day and being near a pond and ducks and the outdoors and, you know, the orange leaves from the changing leaf colors. And it's like, okay, so maybe I did have a transcendent day, and I just hadn't acknowledged it yet.
Well, you just did, so that's a good thing. And by the way, pick out one of those photos that are really, really good, and we'll use it on the website, because I need to have a good photo of you anyway. So grab a good one that really shows the motion and so forth.
Well, and I'm glad that I won't have a full-length thing, because I'm only 5'7", and if you're 6'8", you know, your head's going to be way taller than mine, so I know you'll Photoshop them in so that you can have us a little bit on a more even keel.
Oh, that's the beauty of Photoshop. No one can ever tell what the height is, because I always put the heads at the same level, so everybody's the same height.
That's good.
Oh, yeah, what's the point of having Photoshop if you can't level off the heights? I mean...
There you go.
Yeah, it's true. Photoshop is a wonderful thing. You can misuse it, you can abuse it, but... boy, it can also make life really much better. You can, and by the way, it's a great visualization tool, Photoshop. Like, for instance, if you don't like the way you look in a certain way, you can use Photoshop to reshape it, turn it into what you want it to be, and then put that up on your wall and see it.
I mean, I know that even magazine covers where you have the most beautiful, slender, perfect-skinned individual, they still Photoshop it.
Oh, yeah. There aren't any actual people like that, what you see on those magazines.
There are no real people are on magazine covers.
The only way you can get to that is with Photoshop or an equivalent. That's just reality. And before Photoshop, it was airbrushing.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know what airbrushing is, it's kind of what it sounds like. It's paint that gets blown in the air.
So tell me some more things that feel transcendent to you.
Transcendent. Well, I keep coming back to it, but doing this show. I mean, seriously, every time that we do this, it's better than meditating. It's better than yoga. I mean, it's just like it's climbing onto a rocket and seeing how high it's going to go. That's about as transcendent as I can think of at the moment.
In a simplistic way, what I'm hearing is it's lifting you up.
Yes.
It's uplifting. That, to me, would be the transcendence, which is taking you from where you are and giving you more.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Very cool. Well, you know, if we define it that way, I would say I probably experience a lot of transcendence.
Sure.
I just don't use the word very often.
Yeah. Well, you don't think about it that way. And who would? I mean, most of the time, we're just living. We don't need to put the label, well, that's transcendent. It just doesn't work with the flow of the thing.
I use the words breakthrough and aha moments.
Quite often. Okay.
You know. So tell me again what number one was.
Number one is belonging, although we're going to probably have to draw to a close because we're down to about a minute and a half. So 10 seconds on belonging. What did you want to say about belonging?
It's important. I do love the feeling of belonging, but you know what? We'll have to do a whole show on that one.
Okay. That sounds good. Before everybody leaves, I do want to remind you, if you have not yet subscribed to our podcast, first of all, it's free. Second of all, it's easy to do. You either go to the website, loatoday.net. In fact, if you're listening live, you're already there most likely. Just scroll down, you'll see the button. You can also do it through Apple iTunes, or you can subscribe if you're on an Android phone with Google Play. So whatever you do it, please subscribe. And if you're listening to us on PRN, subscribe anyway, because it's always great to have the next show or the previous shows on your phone, even when you're not listening to PRN. So please subscribe. And Wendy, how can people reach you if they want some coaching assistance?
They can come to my website at wendydiller.com.
That's about as simple as it gets. Wendy, it's been a pleasure as usual. I can't wait till next Monday.
You got it. See you all, everybody.
All right. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye.